Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. In a time of crisis for state, local, and school district budgets, governments are trying hard to stretch their dwindling revenues to cover necessary costs. Some are losing the battle. Enter the Emergency Financial Manager, or EFM. EFMs, at the governor's behest, take over municipal and school district operations and ignore the locally elected officials. EFMs have the power to break contracts, sell off public property, and increase debt. Some of Michigan's citizens applaud, while others are appalled. And at least one state court questions the way some financial managers have done their work. On today's show, we'll hear from two groups who are raising the red flag and leading efforts to repeal the EFM law. Unelected crisis management when the whole system is in crisis. I have two guests to discuss this with me today. Joining me by phone is John Filo, the legal director for the Sugar Law Center. Welcome, John.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Fine. It's nice to have you. Tell us about the Sugar Law Center.
The Sugar Law Center was founded in about 1990 with the idea that economic and social rights are human rights and civil rights. We give a great deal of attention in society to, you know, what are traditionally known as more political rights. What we do is try and translate, you know, at least within the structures of the law, greater recognition that your economic and your community rights are as important as any rights you have.
And it was founded by, or in the name of?
Well, it's in the name of Maurice and Jane Sugar. Maurice Sugar was an attorney that was active early with labor unions and the formation of the UAW, and was active in many progressive causes such as poor people rights.
Okay, so we're talking today about the Emergency Financial Manager Program here. Why don't you describe that for people who are unfamiliar with it?
Well, it's an emergency manager program. It shifted the current law from an emergency financial manager program to an emergency manager one. Now, how it got started is it goes back a little ways in our state. There were some real problems in the E-course during the 1980s and during that, you know, severe recession we had at that time. But there was no state law for how the state government could intervene within a city when they had really serious financial problems. E-course at that time went through the court system, which really it's a quasi-bankruptcy at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's not used very often. It's not tailored to address some of the concerns they had. In response to some of the difficulties that happened with that E-course receivership, they enacted the first emergency financial manager law in our state.
That was 88, was it?
I believe that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it was amended again in 1990 to, I think, Public Act 72. And then that was amended several times. Really did not see much use until the early 2000s. And then a number of cities went through an emergency financial manager. And then last March, we saw the enactment of Public Act 4, which moved it from an emergency financial manager to an emergency manager.
And what happens once an emergency manager steps in?
Right.
And takes over a city or a school district, what happens then?
Well, they become your government. That single individual has all the authority of local government. So any powers your mayor had, now that one individual has those powers. Any powers your city council had, now that one individual has all those powers.
But that person is not accountable to the citizens of the jurisdiction, does not stand for election.
Right, does not stand for election. They're appointed at the, you know, and serve pretty much at the pleasure of the governor and the state treasurer. And citizens have really, within the law, there is no role for citizen sort of input.
Also joining me today on the Lynn Rivers Show is Brandon Jessup. He is president and CEO of Michigan Forward. Welcome, Brandon.
Hey, how you doing, Lynn?
I'm doing fine. I gave John a chance to talk to us about the Sugar Law Center and explain mm-hmm. their mission and what they do. Give us a little background on Michigan Forward.
Yeah, Michigan Forward, we were founded in 2008, and we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan, progressive public policy think tank. What we do is we create state and local policy initiatives for the progress of our urban centers. So we notice that there is a lack of investment on the political side of urban communities. And not really to speaking about Detroit, you know, specifically. I'm talking about urban communities as a whole. So that includes all of Southeast Michigan. You know, that includes the Southfield, because if Detroit goes, Southfield goes, it's the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So we include the suburban communities in our demographic. And as you can see so far, it's been doing pretty well. So,
good.
Yeah.
Good. So, John, I want to go back to you. We were talking just a minute ago about once an emergency manager is put in place, they're largely unaccountable. They have a lot of power. So the question that really is begged is, who decides and how do they decide when an emergency manager will be placed?
Well, in a very general sense, the idea is that there's a financial review team. If the governor, you know, there's a couple ways it can get triggered, but what happens is the governor will say, we need to have a preliminary financial review team. That review team does its work. Then that can get stepped up to a financial review team. Then it does its work. Then it's up to the governor, pretty much the governor, to determine whether there's a financial emergency such that an emergency manager becomes appointed. What is really critical to understand is that within the language of how that sort of stepped-up process works, it really can come down to the discretion of the governor. There's a whole bunch of factors that are objective until you get to a couple factors that pretty much say, or any other variable that the governor chooses to consider.
Now, when we're looking at federal versus state, we have a system of federalism. We have some powers given to the federal government, some powers given to the state. We don't have the same sort of arrangement now when we're dealing with state and local government. Does the state really have almost total control over local and school district legislatures?
Well, there's more power over school districts. No, it doesn't have total control. I mean, that's been an oft-repeated little phrase that people use, is that local government exists at the pleasure of state government.
Right.
Can do what it pleases. Well, what you have to ask yourself in that case is, who is the state? And the state's the people of the state as expressed through their constitution. Our constitution has very definite rights to local government stated within it. So what is happening, though, is when people describe the state, they're assuming that means the governor or the legislature. Well, the governor and state legislature are bound by what the powers that the people have given them through that constitution.
Right, popular sovereignty.
Right, and they're limited in what they can do with local government.
Well, I'm going to come back to the law in a minute, but I want to go to the political side for a few minutes, because I want to turn to Brandon.
Sure.
Michigan Forward is part of a group, maybe one of the leaders in the group that are working hard to see this particular law repealed. Mm-hmm. How is the referendum process going for you folks?
It's been going pretty well, and it's clear that I think we've been going so well that we've caught all the ire of all the political folks in Lansing. We're at over 210,000 petitions, signatures in.
And you need how many?
We needed 161,305. So we've done good. We've got a decent cushion. But, you know, at the same time, we still battle, and John is aware of this as well, that we have a legislature, a very radical legislature, that even wants to thwart our efforts at democracy at this end. So they cut the democracy for communities that already are under emergency management. And you see what has happened recently with the review teams, and we could probably talk about that later.
Yes.
With Detroit and Highland Park, and our efforts to continue to inject democracy in this dictatorship that they want to impose in our communities. And now we still face the possibility of legislation to usurp our efforts to make sure that people have a say in November.
Well, I want to ask John about that, because, John, I remember from my time in the state legislature that oftentimes people would attempt to make a particular provision of law essentially outside of the possibility of referendum by putting an appropriation along with it. In other words, under the state
right.
constitution, you cannot attempt to repeal by the vote of the people appropriations. I believe there was, what, $10 appropriated on this bill, and is that going to prove to be a legal obstacle for this?
I don't think so. That's just a fig leaf that I don't think is going to hold up. I think what part of the considerations and what Brandon is also discussing is the legislature doing an end run around the people after the petitions get filed, that then the legislature does some quickie legislation that, you know, may, for example, would repeal Public Act 4 and pass Public Act 5 that does essentially the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of gamesmanship, though, if there's integrity in the courts at all, should not be upheld.
Mm-hmm. This is the Lynn Rivers Show, and today I'm talking with John Filo and Brandon Jessup about Michigan's emergency financial manager law, or emergency manager law. John Filo is the legal director for the Sugar Law Center, and Brandon Jessup is the president and CEO of Michigan Forward. So I want to stay with you for a minute, though, Brandon, about this political effort.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is affecting a number of cities here in the state. Which, can you name them for me?
Yeah, quite a few cities.
Mm-hmm.
Right now you have the city of Detroit, Inkster, Flint, Pontiac, Benton Harbor, Ecorse. And then you have some cities on a watch list. That includes Saginaw, Hamtramck, the city of Muskegon, and a few other communities all across the state. The state, I believe, Senate Fiscal Agency, reported that this year would be around 80 communities and municipalities that could be facing emergency management this year.
Well, one of the things it seems to me as I sort of watch this this whole movement against the law unfold is there are lots and lots of folks who don't live in those communities who see this as a really bad piece of law. Mm-hmm. What do you think the big gripe is?
The gripe is, and it's ever present. We heard it first from Traverse City, that great community to the north, and what they said was, if they come for you, they can come for me next. And that's the shared, pretty much the theme across all of this grassroots effort, is with Governor Snyder's cuts in revenue sharing, the cuts and you know, the tax breaks and the funding options that we had to rebuild our communities. He's cut all of that. We talk about brownfield development, those things that would bring millions back of just not only to public investment, but private investment. So we see that our communities have been shut out economically. We don't have as much economic opportunity as we've seen in the last 18 months or 18 months ago. And that's a real problem. So if they can go after Detroit, that supplies 40% of the state's water, if they can go after Pontiac, that was a great manufacturing hub, if they can go after Flint, that's working right now to pass a $600 million bond to improve its water and sewer system. Okay, while we're in the middle of revitalization, why would you want to take over these communities right now? What's so ripe about this season? Well, I think it's the fact that our cities are coming back, and they want to make sure that corporate communities have control over how that's going, and that's not the Democratic way.
Well, that's one of the things I was wondering about, is the governor appoints these individuals.
Yeah.
They are accountable to the governor. Is there a sense that there's some cronyism going in here? I mean, how would you characterize the people who are taking these positions and the interests they might represent?
You know, I don't fault anybody that would take this job. In a state that still has double-digit unemployment, in communities that have double-digit unemployment, a job that pays you $400,000 to take someone else's commands and lead, hey, I probably would take it. But at the same time, you have to think of, well, at what cost? And when you think that you're giving the power to an unelected official to do the job of, in the case of the city of Detroit, 10 elected officials and hundreds of city workers. Okay, now you're not prepping that community, and you're not prepping these people for progress. You're really prepping that community for dissolution and for failure. So with that, you know, I would not want to be any emergency manager or in those shoes. And we have to go take a step back and say, well, wait, could we spend that $400,000 a different way? And there's a presidential candidate that always talks about young people giving back and getting back involved in their communities, and that's how you teach work ethic. Well, what's the standard that we're displaying right here in Detroit or in Michigan when you have 13% unemployment and we're giving guys millions of dollars to dismantle communities?
Well, let me follow up on that with John. John, okay, you have a situation where you have an emergency financial manager in, oh, let's say a town like, oh, Benton Harbor, okay? And that emergency manager decides that he would like to sell property owned by the city.
Sure.
Is there anything that city can do about that? Do they have a say in whether it be sold at all, to whom it would be sold to? Do they have any say in this at all?
A short answer.
So
the state treasurer in certain types of property has some oversight, but
people
are cut out of that.
So what's to stop the emergency manager from selling to his brother-in-law to put up a big housing development?
Nothing. Short answer. I mean, you know, you can look at Pontiac right now. There's a bunch of controversy around the essential transferring fire department services from, you know, getting rid of their fire department services and then contracting it out to the city of Waterford, where the emergency manager happens to live and happens to be a neighbor of their Waterford city manager. Mm. Also, Waterford, at least as I'm being told, was running a deficit and needed some funds. And all of a sudden, they found a contract from the city of Pontiac. Now, I think a lot of those facts need to be fleshed out, but here's another problem of the law. There's no requirement that this, you know, if it went through a normal city council process, this is all public. This is, there's hearings on it.
There would be hearings.
The contract
right.
comes up. There's a vote on whether the contract gets approved or not. With the emergency manager, that sort of public, you know, exposure is not there.
Right. In terms of responding to the public will, now we know, as I said, John just said they can sell property. The public can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the negative response. Are they trying to tap into the positive response? In other words, are these managers trying to come in, build community, be a part of the community, sort of advance the priorities of that community?
You know, I don't want to give you another short answer. But no, and it's very clear, and this is how you see that happening. In Flint, Michael Brown, the emergency manager of Flint, his first steps was to once again regulate and handcuff their city council. So he barred them from meeting and or having any conducive meetings. They can only open a meeting, read the minutes of the last meeting, and close that meeting. Then secondly, he told the mayor, hey, guess what? We're going to lay you off for a couple of weeks. So he laid him off for 2 weeks and then brought him back a few weeks later at 60% of his pay. But he closed two very important offices that really work and engage community development. One was the federal grants office. The second was the community development office. Now, these are two avenues where small businesses, nonprofits easily go into for access for to respond to proposals for building and X, Y, and Z. Those are the different areas and whatnot. But now those doors are closed. So the people that have the tools to build communities are the first ones to get shut out. The elected officials, the nonprofits that pledge to do that type of work, and also the private interests or small businesses that have the means and the capabilities to do that work on a local level. So emergency managers have no accountability towards the sustainability of the city. Really, they are dictators on steroids. They are... the hatchet guy that we always worry about coming to our corporate offices to right-size things. That's what these guys are. And now they have the full force of the law behind them.
Well, John, I want to turn back to you since we're talking about the law. And we mentioned earlier that the argument that gets put forward is that the cities essentially govern themselves at the pleasure of the legislature. But let's kind of stretch that out. Could the state of Michigan, through its legislature with the governor, could they fire, not through an emergency manager, but could they fire the governor of Flint? Could they sell property belonging to a city? In other words, is that a power that the state possesses, or is this a power we have sort of created in the legislative cauldron in Lansing?
You know, it would really depend on the particulars. One thing is, if the state was going to act with respect to a particular city, all right, let's say force the sale of some particular piece of property, there'd have to be some compensation for that property, but the state would have to act through what's called a local act, local legislation, to force it to happen. To get local legislation through, 2/3 of the state legislature would have to agree to it. That would have to be a 2/3 vote, both houses, of all people in office. Then there would have to be a majority vote in that locality. In other words, if you're going to act on that local level, if the state is, there's a really high standard they have to pass to do that. But obviously, they've bypassed that.
But what's the legal reasoning? Where do these extraordinary powers come from? If this legislature would not have the same sorts of power that the emergency manager is now wielding, where do they come from?
Well, I think they're playing on two things. One, I don't think they have that power. I mean, that is one of the areas we're contesting it in the lawsuit, is that you can't transfer to an emergency manager the power you yourself don't have.
Correct.
And that's, you know, I think that's a very tough thing for this state to try and get around. But the state is playing on at least two aspects. One, that notion you said at the outset, that local government's a creature of the state, and the state can do what it wants. It's hoping that, you know, pretty much you don't unpeel the layers.
Right. If you say it long enough, people will believe it.
Exactly. The second one is our state constitution doesn't explicitly say you have a right to vote for your mayor of a city or a village in the Constitution. However, it has a whole article, Article 7, that addresses local government. When you read that and understand the scheme that's put in place, it's clear you have the right to vote. You have the right to vote because you have the right to establish your own charters. And then a charter provision that's mandatory that they have to have a legislative body that's elected.
So have there been legal challenges? Has this gotten before a court? I know that in the Highland Park case, the open meetings, and we'll talk about that in a second, but the whole legal justification for the act, has that been in front of a court yet?
Well, we filed a case with a co-counsel from the Center for Constitutional Rights, from a couple of great law firms who are helping us out, Herb Sanders, Goodman and Hurwitz, and Miller Cohen, and the National Lawyers Guild here in Michigan. Those issues are before the court in that case.
But they've not yet been heard, correct?
Right. What happened is when we filed the case, the governor and his people requested what's known as it's a discovery period where you learn the facts behind all this. Governor and those folks requested a long discovery period. We requested a short one, but the court gave the longer one. Then immediately after that, the governor filed with the Supreme Court saying, this case needs to be cited right now. The discovery period is going to be too long in the lower court. All right? So it was a bit of gamesmanship that's going on there. They filed that with the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court appears divided on whether they're going to take it. It's now been about 4 or 5 months, and they haven't taken it. Now, through that period at the trial court, things should have proceeded normally if the governor and the treasurer actually wanted this heard quickly. Discovery would have continued while the Supreme Court was considering this request from the governor. However, at the trial court, the governor then filed at least 4 or 5 motions to try and prevent any further discovery, appealed the discovery motions to the Court of Appeals, sought a stay of any further actions in the lower court, and essentially has dragged that entire proceeding out.
So essentially they're using legal maneuvering to keep the question out of the hands of the court.
They are. It appears that the only forum that they're comfortable hearing it is the Michigan Supreme Court. And you can draw your own conclusions on why they want it there instead of anyone else. I mean, you know, one thing is we're not afraid of the Michigan Supreme Court in that, you know, if we get a fair hearing, we think we can persuade, you know, a genuine conservative or a liberal on this.
Mm-hmm.
It's about constitutional rights. It's about
democracy.
You know, democracy, right.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show, and today we're talking about Michigan's emergency financial management law. And my guests are John Filo. He's the legal director for the Sugar Law Center, and the president and CEO of Michigan Forward, Brandon Jessup, is here with me as well. Brandon, I want to turn to you. We were just talking about Highland Park. Part and parcel of this law, at least as people would argue, is that it's undemocratic. It's unaccountable. There was a legal dust-up in Highland Park over the way the emergency financial manager was operating. Give us a little bit of background on that.
Well, as we've seen in all the other municipalities that have had emergency manager, the review team conducts meetings in the dark. It's the same thing with the preliminary review. So what happens is from a regular, common, everyday guy, when you see this process start, you hear the news, oh, we're in a financial emergency, and the state's coming in. So with Highland Park, they conducted a 30-day preliminary review. The Highland Park review team stepped in and said, well, we need to conduct a further review. And they had none of those meetings in open with the public, nor were they meeting with the school board as a whole. So Robert Davis, as well as the Detroit branch of NAACP and Michigan Forward, we petitioned to the governor and to the treasurer, say, wait, we suggest that the review teams, they conduct meetings in the open, under the Open Meetings
Act.
Of course, the governor did not answer our letter, and Robert Davis at the same time had filed a lawsuit. So what we've seen, and John, once again, he kind of alluded to this earlier, this is that legal wrangling that they do. So you see Governor Snyder wants to follow some of the meetings. Well, I'll make a public announcement that we're going to announce an emergency manager, but they would have done that anyway. And once again, you see the shuffling of the cards. You see, as the first meeting of the Detroit review team was not conducted in Detroit. It was conducted in Lansing. The meeting yesterday, on Wednesday, of the Highland Park review team to decertify the appointment of emergency manager and to go back and recommend the same guy was done in Detroit, not in Highland Park. So once again, I don't know what Governor Snyder doesn't understand about accountability, transparency, and democracy, but it's very clear that he needs a strong and long course in that. Maybe he should come back down here to EMU and take some policy classes.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. So ultimately, John, the Ingham Court takes action and says this has to be done in the open. Does that affect all of the emergency managers, or is that essentially limited just to the situation in Highland Park?
Well, and Brandon, you can chime in if you have some different thoughts on that. Right now, we're waiting to see the actual order that is written by the judge. He's ruled from the bench orally, but depends on the actual language says. I think the one that there's some challenges for sure, but the one that's most likely is probably Flint, because it received its emergency manager after Public Act 4 was passed. The other ones were appointed prior under the prior law, although they're sort of grandfathered in under Public Act 4. I think it's more difficult to conceive how you could go back and undo it, although we're certainly going to be looking at it with other folks.
Mm-hmm. And one thing about the impact of Judge Collette's ruling, it really affects, in our purview, Michigan Forward and Detroit NAACP, that it affects Inkster, that their review teams need to disband, right, be reappointed, and start the entire process over. The same thing as far as Detroit is concerned, Muskegon Heights, who their review team has not met yet, and also as far as Flint as well. So we believe that that entire process should be to scratch, start all the way over from the beginning. But I don't know if Governor Snyder wants to buy that much time. You know, that's a lot of money spent. But to be honest, and we have to be fair and just about this process, if you're going to manage public dollars, why would you not want to have the public in that conversation?
Well, and public quality,
right,
of life. Cities deliver services that people rely upon.
Absolutely. Water, fire, police, emergency, all those things. So the cuts that emergency managers consider to take, and let's take eCourse for instance. eCourse right now has approximately two public firemen for the entire city of eCourse. And this is a cut made by the emergency manager and they've had emergency manager for almost 4 years now. And she's continuously cut, and cut until she couldn't cut anymore. But we always say, well, Mr. or Mrs. Emergency Manager, how do we create revenue? Well, I don't want to create any new local ordinances because then I need to get the city council involved to do that. So they don't want to take those measures. They want to continue to cut and deplete and dissolve communities. And that's what the issue is.
John, let me turn to you. Could a community that is under is working under an emergency manager, if they so chose to raise revenue, in other words, to tax themselves, could they do so? Or does the emergency manager essentially have a veto?
Well, the emergency manager certainly has a veto. But you run into, issues that I can't say that I'm an expert on the, caps on the taxations you can do within your city, either on real estate or income.
No, but the point that I'm making is if the people in the city said, we don't want to see this happen through cuts alone. We would like to raise revenue through a number of ways. Could they do that, or are they essentially at the mercy of the emergency manager, who may have a particular ideological view on taxes?
That's correct, and I think you are at the mercy of the emergency manager. I can't think of any vehicle that would be available to citizens that could not be overruled by the emergency manager.
Yeah, Jabrandon.
Yeah, Detroit Public Schools had a case something like that. The last bond proposal that we passed, a $500 million bond proposal to build new schools in the city and to shore up the school district, that was encouraged and really campaigned hard for by the previous emergency manager, Robert Bob. Mm-hmm. And yes, so it raised taxes on homes and homeowners in the city of Detroit. But what happened was we saw that it didn't really solve the deficit. It put the district into deeper debt. So now the city, the school district has a debt of over $300 million. And then plus the city's on the hook for over $800 million in bonds to build schools. And now they're closing two of those schools that were covered by this bond and turning them into privately held charters. So we sometimes, if an emergency manager does go and engage with the public, will the public remain to have control over the services in the public mm-hmm. institutions that they're supporting in the bill?
Now, you're working through state law on mm-hmm. a referendum. Referendum allows the people to repeal a law passed by the elected representatives mm-hmm. of the state. But there's no provision for the people of Detroit, for example, to have a vote to undo things that Robert Bob or another emergency manager has done with the schools.
Yeah, there is none at this point. And another we did a test of this in August of 2011 in Pontiac, where we introduced a ordinance to the city council to rezone their public vending option. So the entire city of Pontiac would be open to public vending for small businesses. The emergency manager refused to take up that ordinance at all. So you see, once again, to kind of undo some of
what was the reasoning for that? I mean,
there was no reasoning, there was no response.
Were there fiscal issues to be considered?
There was no reasoning, there was no response at all. And really, I believe the issue was the fact that it called for the city of Pontiac, the city council, to manage the funds that had come in from the parcels that they had sold or the vending permits that they would have sold. At the most, the cap or the projected revenue has been around $200,000. Not a lot of money, but that's enough to handle all the council staff, and it would have paid for the mayor and everyone else.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about the communities becoming self-sufficient, and the EM's just straight blocking it.
Yeah, John, did you want to make a comment?
No, I do think that it highlights what you're getting at with those line of questions. That's the very reason we have a democracy, to avoid having an ideological, dictatorship. There are going to be some communities who want to get back to their recovery through just cuts. There'll be others who experiment through raising revenue, and there'll be a host of range in between.
Mm-hmm.
What we've done, and that's the nature of our democracy. Historically, you go back, that's some beautiful expressions of it. What we're doing is saying democracy is the problem.
Well, right, that the people shouldn't be...
We need to get that out of the way.
People shouldn't be allowed to make these decisions.
Right.
Well, there's a listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show. You're listening to us on 89.1 WEMU. We're talking about Michigan's emergency financial management law. I'm talking with Brandon Jessup. He's the president and CEO of Michigan Forward, and John Filo, the legal director of the Sugar Law Center. I want to, John, we were talking about the idea that this is anti-democratic. There is also, at least in public statements, there's sort of this undercurrent of punishment. These are communities that have done something wrong.
Right. I think this is tied. It all seems so new, but this is a very old idea in this country, right, is that the poor, certain groups that we don't like, really shouldn't be allowed to vote.
They brought it all on to themselves, yeah.
Right. They're just, even if it's not bitter, it's paternalistic. It's, they just shouldn't. There's a long history of that in this country, and we evolved to the point where we recognize that wealth, race, they shouldn't be credentials in your voting. You can't get around the fact that with this law, what we're saying is, the state at its discretion can take away your right to vote locally in a poor community.
But isn't this happening? Isn't it happening not just in poor communities through the EFM stuff. Isn't it also happening as the state legislature takes away discretion from local school boards and cities about the kind of health care they offer their employees or marriage benefits or you name it? We now seem to be having lots and lots of decisions being made in Lansing, and at the same time closing off lots and lots of options for locally elected officials.
They are, but I will say with this law, I don't think you can divorce the wealth of the community from it. And there's an assumption that in these communities, in Benton Harbor, in Detroit, in Ecorse, in Pontiac or Flint, that the local officials were either corrupt or just grossly incompetent. Mm-hmm. They just can't handle it. And we have laws to go after corruption. If that's the case, I don't think there's a citizen in Benton Harbor or Detroit wouldn't say, get the corrupt official.
Right.
We also have ways to get after someone who is grossly incompetent in their office. Let's say they were just wasting money. There's ways to get that person out of office. But we're bypassing any finding of financial mismanagement, bypassing any finding of corruption, and ignoring the very real economic crisis that exists across the country and throughout the state in terms of jobs and our property, foreclosure and just the collapse of the value of property. We're putting all that aside as if it doesn't matter and just saying the local officials did it. Something was wrong with our local officials, and by extension, that these residents
can't govern
themselves.
They just
don't vote for the right people.
They can't govern themselves.
Right.
I want to raise the issue of race here. I mean, one cannot ignore the fact that the cities that are under emergency managers right now and many on the wait list are minority-majority cities, are majority African-American. I'm going to turn to you, Brandon, about that. How do you see this from your perspective at Michigan Forward?
Mm-hmm. The law itself, we've been asked this question quite a few times, but the law itself is not a racist policy. But when we look at the numbers and you say over 600,000 African-American voters have been disenfranchised from their right to vote under this law, over 1 million residents in majority-led cities have been impacted economically by this law. When you look at the fact that communities such as Jackson and Allen Park and whatnot that have more majority or more Caucasian populations, where they're the majority, you haven't seen a response back from the governor when they call for a review team, when the citizens of those communities have called for Public Act 4 to be enacted. We have to raise that question. Well, Governor Snyder, what's the issue? Or Treasurer Dillon, why would you not apply this law fairly? And that's the real issue, is the fact that Governor Snyder and Treasurer Dillon know that if they applied this law fairly, that and equally and just all across the state of Michigan, they'd be overburdened. And now they'll technically have taken over the affairs of 30% of the municipalities in this state and over 150 school districts in this state. They don't want that job, but they do see the resources and the value of taking control of over the city of Detroit's finances. And let's be clear, it was the city of Detroit that gave a loan to the state of Michigan when they were in the hard times. It was the city of Detroit that first it took the principle of shared sacrifice and not raising taxes on the city workers and city residents over 6 or 7 years ago that would have curbed this now fiscal crisis that we're in. So we ask the governor to look at the numbers and how he's applying the law. And when you look at the application of this law, you have to say, well, wait, there is something wrong here. There's something wrong with the Kool-Aid. The drinking water has been poisoned. And the people who are being forced to drink that water are the minority communities in the state of Michigan.
Now, I know that the voting, I'm turning to you, John. I know the Voting Rights Act deals with federal voting rights issues, but is there any legal question to be raised here when you have 600,000 African-American voters being deprived of a real vote in their communities as a result of this state action?
I think there is, and I think you will see, depending on how things go in the next few weeks, that's a very well find its way into court. And I'm not an expert on Voting Rights Act, but we've looked at it from the Equal Protection
right.
under the Equal Protection Clause. We have the state giving people a right to vote in local elections through the Constitution and then taking it away from some communities. I think it's very hard to get around the fact, to turn your eyes from the fact that these are overwhelmingly poor communities. And poverty, wealth, it's in this country, there's a correlation with race. When you look at the towns that currently have emergency managers and add up the population, it's over 50% of the state's population of black folks. Now when we start adding in potential towns, we get up over 70%. I just think basic decency tells you if you're going to disenfranchise that much from any group in this state, you got to go back to the drawing board.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show here on 89.1 WEMU. I'm talking with John Filo and Brandon Jessup about Michigan's emergency manager program. I want to turn to you, Brandon. Has the governor ever spoken to this issue of race? I know it comes up. I've read it. I've heard it. Has the state ever addressed it?
No. No. And they don't feel the need to address it. Once again, in a fiscal emergency, the only color they're seeing is green. And I can understand that. But as far as the claims that John has raised, the claims that Michigan Forward has raised, the claims that all of the proponents for repeal of this law have raised, he hasn't answered not one. And unfortunately, we have to continue to go to court to get him to face the fact that this is bad policy. Emergency management is wrong. So if anything, I believe that Governor Snyder needs to learn how to be more sensitive to the issues of the constituency that he governs, that he was elected to govern.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you again about something having to do with Highland Park.
Uh-huh.
I heard maybe even this morning that they're going to have a Payless Pay Day tomorrow with their teachers.
Well, this is Governor Snyder, wagging his finger at those who want to use democracy to inject some fairness and justice in what's going on across the state. I don't care what would have happened with Mr. Martin if he would have stayed as emergency manager in Highland Park. He just began to lay plans on Monday, this past Monday. So what could he have done in the last 2 days that would have avoided a Payless Payday outside of petitioning the state for an emergency loan? What's going on right now is you see the state holding back resources from Highland Park Public Schools.
Because they raised this
concern. Because they raised this issue and this concern. They're doing the same thing in Inkster right now. And normally with municipalities, and Lynn, you're familiar with deficit elimination plans. And when you fall into a deficit, you have to go back and X, Y, and Z. The city of Inkster has a petition to the state governor, I'm sorry, to the treasurer, for a $3 million emergency loan, so they can shore up their deficit and close the gap and go back into black before 2014. Now that's a short time span, and they have a strong plan to do that. But yet the treasurer's office has not responded back to their request and has not answered the deficit elimination plan that they've submitted to the state. Why? Because they want to put in an emergency manager in the city of Inkster. That's why.
Let me ask you, John, from the perspective of state law, we have an educational system here in the state of Michigan. We are supposedly committed to educating every child. But when we see situations like what's going on with Highland Park, where they're not going to be able to pay their teachers, or we're going to see in some communities salaries and benefits slashed to the bone, what happens to the educational system, and what happens with the equal protection, the idea that we educate all kids, we give to our kids to our best ability so that they become the most productive citizens possible? I mean, this looks like you are having cities impacted not just today, but impacted in ways that are going to hurt for many years in the future.
That's absolutely right. And it's always been a difficult question, and the law has struggled to deal with it, that we have a right to education, but how do we equalize that right? Where's the threshold for it? I do find it interesting. I would have to echo everything that Brandon had just previously said, in that maybe the governor is helping to shape future law, though, however, in almost trying to think of the right word, but taking retribution out against these people, and particularly against the kids, by not willing to fund the Highland Park schools during this transition until they find out, what's going to be the future of the schools, simply because he got caught violating the law.
So you think it was retaliation?
I think it was very much retaliation.
So, I mean, we're back to this, what is a basically a Democratic small d issue, which is when the people are unhappy with their government, they're supposed to be able to change their government. But it looks to me like you have a situation through legal maneuvering, through attempting to close off elections, that people in Michigan, and particularly people in these communities, are being deprived of their basic rights of citizenship. I mean, is that Brandon? Is that a fair statement?
It's fair, and it's probably as fair as it can go. And you know, you asked a question earlier about education and what is the effect. And in 2010, in Michigan Forward, we held our inaugural Urban Economic Forum. We asked the question: does emergency management work for Detroit public schools? And the seniors and juniors from Munford High School said very clearly, no, it doesn't. We didn't have a counselor. We had one counselor for our entire high school, the high school that had been closed. Well, I'm sorry, the high school that had taken another, I believe, 600 students from other communities in the city to help ease the burden of all the schools that had been closed. So now you had one counselor for a high school of over 1,200 students, one counselor. And these are the conditions that emergency managers create. And then also, Public Act 4 gives emergency managers now power over academics. So now they control the curriculum.
But is there priority? In other words, no. Their mission, is it to make the schools better, or is it simply to cut spending?
It's to cut spending. And to ease or to stop the bleeding, the hemorrhaging. But we know that school districts aren't self-funding operations. Public education was a mindset put forth by Thomas Jefferson, that this is what we do to pay forward. So when you have a school district that's in a deficit, that's running a deficit, you don't cut, you find ways to raise revenue. But right now, in the city of Detroit, you have classrooms with 60 kids in them. To this day, 60 kids under emergency management. So how do you kill a community if you can't go directly into it to dissolve it? You
strangle it.
You strangle it by killing its future of having the right education and preparation to lead that city in the future. Mm.
John, are other states going through similar situations? Are there laws like this in other states?
There is no state that's equivalent to our law. The closest is Rhode Island. And that was one point I wanted to speak to just briefly, Lynn, is that, you know, it's often been portrayed is that we're in this either-or situation. There's either bankruptcy for the school district or for the city, or we have to have Public Act 4. And there's nothing in between. Well, there's a whole range of in-between of proven other options. New York State has gone through, a number of their municipalities and cities have gone through severe financial distress. New York City was in worse shape than any of our cities are right now in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what New York State has taken is a model where they do it on a city by city. They address legislation to address the problems of that particular city. In each case, retaining the local officials, but often having a financial board who has ultimate say on what's paid, what's not.
All right.
But they may set budgets and say, you have to operate within this.
That's going to have to be our last word for today. So John Filo from the Sugar Law Center, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Liz.
And Brandon Jessup from Michigan Forward, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And listeners, thank you for being here. And join me next week for another edition of the Lynn Rivers Show, when we'll talk about the news, history, politics. See you then.